Okay. It's actually this. Not so many this evening, but still I'm surprised how many of you have come for this evening's talk, because many people were here last night until past midnight, including me. Many people are tired. If they didn't come here, they've probably gone to some other place which probably tired them even more. So many people are exhausted today. So anyway, welcome all of you brave people who came to listen to another talk, especially those who were here last night as well. You're addicts. But it's a nice thing to be addicted to. Very good. So in a few moments, when everything is ready to live stream and to start, very good, we're ready to roll. So again, welcome everybody to another Dharma Talk, the first of 2016, although this is just a convention, New Year's. I said last night we have three New Years in our Buddhist society, three celebrations per year. Other places only have one, so you get extra by coming to this place. Western New Year, Chinese New Year, and Southeast Asian New Year, South Asian New Year. That's sometime in April. So more celebrations, more festivities, great fun for you, more work for me. But I don't mind working, and over the past year, looking about where I've gone and what I've done, it still amazes me at first the sorts of interesting places you can go to as a Buddhist monk. You know, you go to Google, Facebook, their headquarters, their inner sanctums, and what am I doing there? I give the keynote address at the 2015 World Computer Congress. What do I know about computers? Not that much. You give all these talks about good governance and politics. Know nothing about that. You give talks in radio stations on adult themes about sex. I certainly don't know anything about that. And sometimes people ask me all these questions on psychology, on sociology, on philosophy, education. And remember that time I gave a talk on shipping? Which I really, I don't know anything about shipping, honestly. I've been in a boat, you know, but I know as much about shipping as if you've been in the Rottnest Ferry. It's not very far, that's just over to an island just off Perth for those listening on the internet. But why was my response to the questions on shipping regarded as breakthrough such an interesting response that people worldwide, when that article was syndicated, replied to the organ, to the interviewer, that Ajahn Brahm, we don't know who he is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. And by all measures, I should not know what I'm talking about. I've never studied shipping. I've never studied sex. I don't know too much about computers, honestly. But still, that you are wise enough to actually be invited to all these great conferences and just get free passage, you know, into places like Google headquarters and Facebook. Why is it? Where does that wisdom come from? It certainly does not come from universities. Because universities usually don't teach you very much. They teach you old knowledge. They teach you what other people have discovered. And even research and development, that is usually a small part of universities' budget these days. Mostly it's to try and get foreign students in, because they're more expensive. You get more money that way than getting the locals in. Which means that there's something missing in education. Also, you're very rare to find that in schools. It's one of my favorite sayings. I say this in monasteries, I say this in temples, I say this in conferences, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. We are conditioned by our learning to see things only in one way. We're conditioned by language to be limited in our understanding. That is one of the reasons why the talk I'm giving this evening is called The Wisdom Born of Silence. The reason I'm giving this talk, I gave this talk over in Penang recently, and it went down very well. And it works. By all accounts, tonight's talk should be absolutely hopeless. Reason is that I've been working usually so hard. Look, the last time I was here, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I forget now, Friday night talk, Saturday afternoon meditation, lots of other counselling and stuff afterwards, Sunday afternoon going back to my monastery, because, you know, these monks, I'm supposed to be their teacher. I think if you have a neglected parent, if you were neglected by your parents when you're young, that's what these monks feel like sometimes, neglected, abandoned by their teacher, because I go off overseas. Sunday night with monks, Monday morning, early, going to Penang, teaching, retreat, meditation at 5 o'clock, chanting, talk, 8 o'clock, counselling all day, answering questions of people who were on the retreat and people who were just blow-ins, talks in the afternoons, talks in the evening. I've been talking so much since I was last here, every day at least one talk, usually two or three. And sometimes, personally, this is a personal reflection, I really think I'm a talk machine. You just turn me on and I give a talk. Anywhere, anytime, any place, no matter how tired you are. And of course, you know, coming back here, arriving in the afternoon, straight here, organising last night's events, which I haven't seen, it was actually very interesting. Because I innovate. I do think outside the box. Where everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. That's why every New Year's Eve, New Ajahn Brahm's party, last night, for those of you who weren't here, we had a little contest based on the TV talent show, The X Factor. Now, The X Factor is very worldly. Try to find out who has got talent, who's got that special something, which they can't really put a name to, so they call it X Factor, who will make it in the world of entertainment. Of course, I'm not interested in entertainment. I'm interested in spirituality. So the X Factor last night, who's got it in them to be a monk or a nun? These secret qualities. And so I had everybody, I gave them a robe each, and see who could wear the robe properly. Other little, really good fun. You might think it's easy to wear these robes. And I said, sometimes people keep criticizing me for my robe falls off. You try wearing this robe and being active, not just sitting still, but really active. It's not an easy thing to do. When you give the blessings with the holy water, I had that as a test for people. And one person, I won't say who his, was blessing with his holy water, and a swish come out of her hand. She threw it at somebody. That's not really how to bless people. So it was really good fun last night. But it was also, I don't know if she's here this evening, this little girl, when everybody had to give like a Dhamma talk. And I'm still amazed by this response. I don't know how old she was. We gave her the Pali name, not really a Pali name, because you know, monks have the name Mudu, Brahm. We gave her Cappuccino. That's what they. Anyway, this little Cappuccino girl, when asked to give like 1 minute Dhamma talk, she started talking about jhanas. And you can't think to get into a jhana. You have to follow this beautiful light. And even now, it's 24 hours later almost, I'm still stunned. Oh, where on earth she got this from? Amazing. So, you know, that girl's got an X factor. So when I do these little things, you innovate, do things differently, just for actually to get some more interesting stuff coming out of life. When you always do things the same, when you always think the same, you don't see very much. And so one of the reasons why, you know, I am invited to many places to teach, and weird places too, places you never expect to see a monk. The reason you do that is because, you know, somehow or other, the training you get in stillness allows you to see things which other people just cannot see. Your wisdom is wider. And you go to universities and you stun people. How on earth did you learn that? Did you study psychology? Did you study medicine? No. And even to, was it CSIRO, to give a talk to the Physics Society there, stunned people. I did know a bit about physics, but modern physics, you know, it's been, what is it, 30, 40, over 40 years since I was at university. you sort of keep up to date, but not really the depth of it. But still, you can stun physicists. There was, for example, this is even some years ago, here at UWA, University of Western Australia, I was doing a presentation with David Blair. Now, he's still the professor of physics at UWA, still a good friend. And I remember this little interchange we had, you know, at an event there. And when I said, you know, well, where does the universe come from? You know, because it's a basic law of science. I'm sure everybody knows this one. That you cannot create mass energy. You cannot destroy it. Now, energy, mass, it just changes from one to the other. But energy cannot be created nor destroyed. I'm sure you've heard that. So, the question comes, where did this energy called, you know, the universe come from? Where did the planets, the dark energy, everything, where did it all come from? Because it cannot be created, cannot be destroyed. Was the beginning of this universe just a time when the laws of physics just didn't hold? Or is the laws of physics, which is basically logic, reason, was it always there? So in that little part of the discussion, just thinking from silence, I said, well, look, I know from the physics which I remember, there is a physical quantity called negative energy. Now, to explain that to you, that is like, if you remember your high school physics, science, what they called potential energy. That if something is in a gravitational field, this clock, to take this free from the Earth's gravitational field, it takes up a lot of energy. That's why they have to have these huge rockets, basically putting an explosion, you know, up the astronaut's bum. I think that was, who said that? One of the great astronauts. He said, that's like going off into outer space. You know, fortunately you've got lots of metal between you and the explosion, but that's basically what it is. A big bomb under your arse to actually to propel you up into space. And please excuse me for using the language which you use. So anyway, that's what it's like. And that's the energy you need just to free this from a gravitational field. So being in a gravitational field is a form of negative energy. That's one. And there's many others. So, just thinking outside the box, you know, because you know how to be silent, so what would it be like, Professor Blair, if the total amount, the sum total of negative energy, negative mass energy in this universe equaled the amount of positive mass energy in this universe? That's a valid concept. So if all the planets, solar systems, everything, and the energy fields all came together, they totally balance, so mass energy vanishes. You cannot create mass energy. We don't need to, because the sum total is zero. So go back, that's where it came from. If you add everything together, it's zero sum. Universe is a zero sum game. And when I said that, he looked at me, and I still remember the expression on his face. Adrian Brown, I never realized you are so up to date. Omega equals one. I don't know what omega means, but it was a ratio to negative and positive energy. He said, wow, where did you get that from? Easy. From silence. And that's in the world, the wisdom born of silence. And it's amazing just how, if you want to innovate, because a lot of times when I go to these places, you know, it's sometimes these are business places, they are governments. And basically they realize in all forms of life, you cannot do things the same old way. It does not work. We've got plenty of problems already. We have to keep innovating. Medicine, is medical science working? If it was, we wouldn't need to be building so many new hospitals. We aren't curing people. They're getting sick. Yeah, you may cure one disease, they come in next week with another disease. You know, it's just, as they say, kicking the can down the road. Prisons, are we solving the problem of crime? Again, prisons are getting overcrowded, we need to build new ones. What else aren't we solving? Wars? Ha 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 ha. There's still conflicts between people. So, governments, industries, yeah, we get lots of innovation, but soon everybody does the same old thing, and then the industry just collapses. Innovation is so, so important. In life, medicine, and in your life. Are you going to do in 2016 the same old stuff you did in 2015? If you did, you're dead. You're not innovating, you're alive. And so innovation means not letting your learning, even in Buddhism and even in Dhamma, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Because have you ever seen that learning, what's written in the books, or what's recorded on YouTube, stands in the way of you seeing things for yourself? How many difficult problems in this world arise from people following old books which are way past their use-by date? Religious books, holy texts. They call them holy texts because there's so many holes in them. You can drive a bus through some of those arguments. That's why they call holy texts. There's just nothing much left in there. Just like if you have an old book and you leave it on your shelf long enough, they silverfish, they bite on the edges, you get the worms actually eat through it. So that's what they call full of holes. But still people believe in that rather than believing in the wisdom born of silence. And certainly the Buddhist books, that's why I loved those books, they said don't believe the books. It's one of the only books which said don't believe what we say. Somebody sent me a nice cartoon the other day. A little book in the self-help section. Great little joke. Hopefully I can put the cartoon into words without any pictures. And the book was entitled How to Be Happy on the outside. The happiness industry. You go to a bookshop and there's sections on how to be happy. Now, how to be happy is mindfulness. The latest thing. Just a craze. How to be happy. And they opened the book, and the book said, no one is happy. Next question, problem solved. And then the fellow was hugging the book with a huge smile on his face. Ah, no one is happy. That's the secret of happiness. So, everyone here, did you have a happy 2015? It was impossible, wasn't it? And many of you were here and got the blessing last year this time when I said Happy New Year to you. What a stupid blessing that is. Because I'm wishing you what is impossible. When I say have a Happy New Year, you should actually sue me for that, for misrepresentation of the truth. Are you going to have a happy 2016? No way. You're going to have problems, difficulties, arguments, sicknesses, just like last year. Realizing there's no happiness in the world is great joy. I'm going off the topic here, but that was one of Ajahn Chah's famous poses. So much so, I've got a photo of him doing this in my room in Bodhinyana Monastery to inspire me. Because I remember him doing this. He has his arms up here with a big smile on his face. And he's saying, the caption of the photograph is, joy at last, joy at last, to realize there's no happiness in the world. That was incredibly deep and powerful. When you search for happiness, you only find suffering. When you realize this is just the world, you're going to go through separations, divorces. You're going to meet again and fall in love again. You're going to have arguments and reconciliations. You're going to have your sickness and health. You have the jokes which really work and the jokes which no one can understand. Welcome to life. Because I got a complaint over the internet. Last talk I gave here, there was no jokes. So they complained. So in order to make them not complain this time, here is this evening's bad joke. There was a Russian man, and he was so, he was praising and boasting about his son, His son had a job which was bringing in $2 or $3 million every year, a really big salary. And his friends asked, what does he do? Is he a doctor? Is he a lawyer? No, said the Russian, he is a sports mechanic. And they said, sports mechanic? I've never heard of that before. What does a sports mechanic do? Well, he fixes soccer games, he fixes cricket matches. He's a sports mechanic. I thought it was a nice little joke. It's not recommended. Because I say these things, it doesn't mean they're endorsed by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Please don't sue us. But if you want to know what a sports mechanic is, now you know. But anyway, back to where was I? Oh, wisdom born of silence is when you learn how to be silent. Don't just believe what you're told. Don't even believe what you think. Because sometimes all your thinking has been so programmed by your education, by your culture. Now, one of the things I learned when I was in Thailand, really weird, but totally different culture, never been colonized by European culture before. Little simple things. Because just outside the monastery, one evening, after a big party, just like last night, there was this one villager was driving home from another village after the party, drunk, on a bicycle, on the wrong side of the road, with no lights on. He was totally drunk, driving on the highway, wrong side of the road, no lights on, and he got creamed by a bus, killed. The bus had his lights on. The bus, you know, was on the correct side of the road. The bus driver didn't have any alcohol or drugs in him. But the bus driver had to run away and flee. Because in Thai law, the bus driver would be guilty. When I heard that, that's unfair. It's a goddamn bicyclist's fault. He's on the wrong side of the road. He was drunk, no lights on. How can you blame the bus driver? Just explain to me that that's the Western way of looking at it. Always looking at the individual's responsibility. But in Thai law, they were saying, no, the bus driver, the bigger vehicle, has the responsibility to look after the smaller vehicles. They have more onus on them to be on the lookout. And so, in Thai law, if that bus driver had been caught, he had to run away and escape till the heat went down, he would have been put in jail for that. Now, the nice thing about that was not to say what is right, what is wrong, but it was a totally different way of looking at things. And that's why I liked it, to challenge me. I mentioned another point, and I've mentioned this, somebody, who was it recently, said, thank you, I'm going to give a presentation to the government about health, and this is really going to help me, because in modern health hospitals there is a great drain on the budget for health, and people are starting to think we may have to sometimes deny people treatments because we can't afford it. So we have to have a moral way of finding out who is worthy of these very expensive treatments and who has to be denied. And that is coming up in all jurisdictions, because with new ways of treating people, great new drugs, you literally cannot afford to give it to everybody. It will bust the whole system, and it's unsustainable. So how can we decide who gets what? And when I told this little story to this professor, she said, great, I've got my answer now. Actually, it was in Singapore, and it was one of the professors, he was also the head of one of the hospitals, but also on the board of the health service in Singapore. I got my answer now, because I read a book when I was a student. And the reason I read it is I wanted to get out of the normal way of thinking, to see things from a totally different angle. And that was a book I've often quoted here called Erewhon by Samuel Butler. Over 120 years ago now that was written. Erewhon was nowhere spelt backwards. It was like a sci-fi, but not out of space. In those days, 120, 130 years ago, there was many parts of this planet Earth which hadn't been explored yet. and which, you know, was maybe held cultures which were totally isolated and different from those cultures of the West. And they imagined finding this place interestingly in New Zealand. It is just a little fantasy. But in this culture, which had been isolated by mountains and other geographical features, they developed a totally different way of looking at things, especially with crime and punishment and health and cures. And in that jurisdiction, anyone who committed a crime, burglary, fraud, embezzlement, they were considered to be sick. It was considered to be a health issue. And so they were treated by doctors. So anybody who stole, anybody he even killed, they said they're not right in their head. So we'll take them to a hospital and treat them. It wasn't considered to be a crime, it was a health issue. And there's obviously a strong argument for that. It's not so far-fetched. Put people in prison, punish them, treat them like animals, become animals, as they say. And, you know, animals, I respect animals, but that's the idea of, like, not being sort of sensitive. Well, animals are actually incredibly sensitive. Maybe I shouldn't call them like that. Treat them like sort of monsters. That might be better. Treat them like monsters, they become monsters. So in this place, they were treated with respect, kindness. It was a health issue. Something's wrong with you. We'll try and help you, treat you to make sure you never go and rob the bank again. And that's actually what it was. And the doctors were called straighteners, not doctors. Interesting. Now, to get you back on the straight and narrow. But anyone who was sick in this community, that was considered to be a heinous crime. It's your fault that you get sick. If you have a heart attack, and the community has to pay so much money, you know, with bypasses, and being in the ICU, giving all these expensive drugs, that costs a lot of money to ordinary taxpayers like you. And it's your fault having a heart attack. Eating too many McDonald's, not exercising, worrying too much, you should take better care of your health. Bad person. There's an argument for that. That you've made, and it's also in this book. Always remember this scene. This poor guy was in the courts of law. He was accused of a very bad crime. He had a cold. And they described the scene. This man, the accused, he didn't really need to plead because the judge looked at him. He was sneezing, snot was coming out of his nose, he was coughing. He said, "It's obvious. A prima facie case. You have a cold. So there's no need for any evidence. Bang. I find you guilty of having a cold. And it's your fault. And you should have taken better care of your health. Slept properly, not have so much stress. And even worse, when you have a virus like a cold, you're spreading it to other people. You are a menace to society. So, and I look at your record, this is not the first time you've been before me with a cold," said this poor guy, sniffling and afraid. "And I told you last time that no more leniency. I'm going to sentence you to 3 years in a cell for having a cold. Your fault, a menace to society." I know there's a sort of argument to that. But what it was doing is making me see things from a different angle. Not to saying one way is better and the other way is worse, but to seeing that even health, some of that is your responsibility. Crime, some of it is a health issue. And when you start seeing it from a different perspective, you get a much better understanding of a truth of wisdom. So some of the people in jail, they shouldn't be in jail. They should be in some rehabilitation place. Some of the people who are sick, they need to take some more responsibility for their health. And not just think, "I'm sick, someone else fixes it up." Some even have to pay for your own treatment, work for it, or do something. It's your responsibility sometimes. So seeing from a different angle gave many more ideas to actually solve some of the problems of our modern world. Even with politics, I was saying this in Malaysia, I mentioned this last night, because I was in Malaysia, and hope I don't get into too much trouble if I go back there. The current Prime Minister, the people have accused him, and obviously innocent until proven guilty, of corruption. And they're wondering, how can we get a good Prime Minister in our country? Same as here in Australia. I don't know how you like the new Prime Minister, but sometimes, why should we be so limited in our choice of Prime Ministers? What, first of all, people say, why do they have to be either Labour or Liberal? Or maybe National Party? Let's make that even wider. Why do they always have to be Australian to be an Australian Prime Minister? Google was founded in the United States, but you don't need to have your CEO of Google to be an American. They just headhunt the best person in the world who can run that corporation. And they make him an offer, or she an offer, and they become the head of Google. Why can't we do that for the Prime Ministership of Australia? Soon we've got I think it's a really great administrator. President Obama is going to be free next year. Why can't we outsource the Prime Ministership of a country? Imagine that. Just, you know, change your way of thinking. Don't just be so narrow. You know, everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. Why not imagine, sort of, next year we invite President Obama to take up the Prime Ministership of Australia. Number one, he's not sort of allied to any party, Labour or Liberal or Nationals or Greens. And he is fair in the sense, you know, that he comes with an open mind. He hasn't been blinded or conditioned by any type of upbringing or any part of faction or party in Australia. Comes with a fresh, open mind and can be fair, can be actually objective. Whether it's environmental issues, whether it's animal issues, whether it's politics or something, they can come in with a fresh view and maybe actually really maybe very innovative. And when we increase the pool of people we can select our prime ministership, isn't it more likely we get a better person to run the country? Why does it have to be an English or a person from Oxford to actually be the Prime Minister of England, of Great Britain? They're always from Oxford, every time. Not from Cambridge. It really sucks if you went to Cambridge. No, but even why it just has to be someone like that? Why can't you actually get them from somewhere else? Get the best person. Now, this is what I talk about, thinking outside the box. The wisdom which sometimes comes when you don't study. You don't read what everyone else says. Because I don't read any psychology books. I write them. I don't read any political science. I make it up as I go along. I don't read anything about shipping. You just, it's quiet, silent, because you haven't been told, that's why you can see. The same with religion. People learn too much and they see too little. And of course, that is where we get arguments from, terrorists from, wars, and all the other problems we have in life. Even, look, how many of you girls have had babies? Did you learn how to have babies? Did someone actually teach you? If they did, some of it's sort of a lot of rubbish. Just do it, you know what to do. So much of life is like that. Because the other day, people were telling me, said, this is again in Malaysia, they said, you're such a skilled public speaker. Did you actually do lessons on public speaking? Did you actually go to courses or read books on it? No, not at all. You just learn by keeping a very peaceful, open mind. Getting feedback. So I can actually see, that's why often when I give a talk I scan you. If I see someone getting out of the mobile phone and starting texting, I realize I've lost you. But if I see you looking at me, especially smiling and laughing, yeah, I've got you. Now that's how to give talks. This is actually what you learn by being mindful, open mind, not thinking, but silence. Thinking just locks you into the past. You've lost your job. So many people say, oh, that's why it's terrible. Why? Because that's what you think, that's what you've been taught. Losing a job is terrible, it's bad, I'm going to be awful. You're just locked into the thoughts which come from what everybody else has told you, rather than just seeing it for yourself. It's wonderful, losing your job. It means you can have a bit of peace and quiet and rest. You're so stressed out, enjoy yourself, do some meditation, go to the beach. You know, while other people are going to work, you can just have a nice walk in King's Park and just look down on all those crazy people in St. George's Terrace having to work so hard. Enjoy it while you can. So that means, you know, you have the opportunities to do this. It's not positive thinking, it's positive from no thinking. Or this, what was it like 10, 20 years ago? People who were gay, they were felt so miserable. They weren't proud. They didn't come out because they thought that there was something wrong with them. Where did those thoughts come from? Were they accurate, good thoughts? Just conditioned by your culture. And unfortunately, even today, in places like Singapore, they still really haven't got it yet. Still living in the past. Still because of culture. What is the culture anyway? Culture is the past. And culture, by its own definition, is always growing, always evolving. What was it? I'm giving another talk. What was it about? I forget what. But it was within an indigenous elder over at, who was it, UWA again? Was it at Curtin? Anyway, one of the universities here. Talking with an indigenous elder, you know, about many, many things. And while I was talking to him, you know, in public, having a discussion, I mentioned to him that all the indigenous culture of Australia, you know, which, you know, you're defending because that's, you know, who you are, fine. But can you change it? If there's something in indigenous culture which doesn't fit, which you think is not really working, can you improve upon it? Even though you've been doing this for about 30,000 years. I remember his look on his face when I asked this question. It's like, he hadn't really thought that before. It's like indigenous culture was sacred, could not be altered. And then he looked at me and said, yeah, actually that's interesting, why not? If you can find a better way to do things, why can't we do it? Why cannot culture change? And in fact, if you don't actually look back upon culture, you know, as imaginary, fantasizing, think it's always been that way, no culture in this world ever remains the same. It always grows, adapts, just like everything else in this world, whether it's planet Earth, whether it's a tree, whether it's a human being, you can see them always growing, changing, adapting. From young to middle-aged to old, giving birth to new people. That's our life, that's culture. Culture is not static. It always adapts and changes. And so that was a wonderful thing which I could give to him. Hopefully he spreads it around. Even indigenous culture can adapt. Just because you think it's been done 30,000 years, doesn't mean it can't be changed. If it's something better, why not? So again, that is the culture just stops you. It fossilizes you. And for the gay people, it hurt them for such a long time. It still does in some countries. Why on earth? What's wrong with that? Nothing. Don't think about it, because if you think about it, that, where do all your thoughts come from? All you've been taught, all you've listened to. My job here is to blast that all away. So you can see things in a different way. And start looking through silence. That's why we meditate. Because when you're quiet, when you're silent, it's like all that old past stuff is pushed aside. You're not seeing things through the prisms, the colored filters of your past, your learning, your culture, or your religion. You can actually see it afresh, see it new. See, like, about having a separation from somebody. I don't know how, please excuse me again, this is gender specific, but this is anecdotal, my experience. You poor women always blame yourself, much more than men ever do. And I say that as a man, because, you know, when I hear you, I feel you. I can get inside your head, understand where you're coming from. I don't know how many women keep blaming themselves on losing your self-esteem. Don't blame yourself. So many things which happen to you are totally not your fault. But you still blame yourself. Much more so than guys. Because I know a guy, I am one. But, seeing that, why do you do that, for goodness sake? Because that's your culture. That's been imposed upon you. Now, many of you, if you haven't come from a Western culture has been so dominant, it's actually basically changed Asian culture. And you always track it back to that Abrahamic religions, Adam and Eve. You know what happened there? Adam ate the apple, but Eve got blamed for it. That's the start of it. Well, maybe it was before then, but you know, you can see just, what did Eve do wrong? Adam had the choice to eat it or not, you know, if you believe that metaphor. And poor old Adam didn't get punished for it, but Eve did. That is totally unfair. That is a totally gender-specific punishment, which is totally irrational. But I always remember giving a talk with the current Archbishop, the Anglican Archbishop, Roger Hurft. And because, you know, he came from Sri Lanka, you know, he has an Asian perspective, and he said this wonderful joke. He said, if the Garden of Eden, where this happened to Adam and Eve, it's only a metaphor, it didn't really happen, but if that was Garden of Eden, hadn't been in Europe or Middle East, if that had been in, say, China or Vietnam, there would never be any problem. Because if the Garden of Eden had been in Vietnam, Adam would have eaten the snake, not the apple. You've been to these old-fashioned Vietnamese restaurants, snakes on the menu. They would have eaten the apple. So, you know, here's a good sense of humour too. So, thank you. That's attributed to Archbishop Roger Hurft. So, you're in trouble for that, Roger, not me. When the Archbishop of Canterbury finds out... No, you won't. So, anyhow. So, thinking outside the box. And when you're silent, it's amazing just how much you can understand. So, look. If you're having trouble with a relationship, don't go thinking about it and worrying about it. That is stops you seeing the problem. So what do people do? Go for a walk by the beach, if you can't meditate. Just go into the forest. Now the conference we held at the GCB, Global Conference in August, there was this therapist, psychologist, becoming very famous, making a lot of money. His therapy, he calls it nature therapy. People in trouble, psychosis, anxiety, depression, he just takes them for a walk in nature. Because isn't it true? He noticed something. Very nice insight. If you go in the city, it's really noisy and you really get tense. But if you go into the forest, say into a monastery or jhana grove, or you go to the beach, you go to some secluded location, doesn't that make you feel good? It makes you feel relaxed, peaceful. Because in that external stillness and silence, not as noisy, or not even as visually noisy. Not many things to see. The forest basically is soft. Shopping centres are harsh. Even the streets are noisy and they are sharp. The beach is blunt. In other words, nothing scratches you there. So in nature, there's something about nature which actually makes people, the psychology heals. Why is that? Such a simple thing. And of course he charges people for this. He charges people for taking them on a bus trip to the coast. It's a bit of a scam, but I'm undermining him. Great, you know, he's helping people. Undermining him by teaching you this. You don't need to have a therapist to take you into the bush. You just need a bus or a car or a bicycle or something. And then you actually feel better. Why? Because really it's a silence there. It's the silence of the Australian bush. In the old days, the silence of these cathedrals I used to go to in Europe. The silence of the car park in Bodhinyana Monastery, which the former building surveyor used to go to just to chill out, to get rid of his stress from work. The silence not only heals you, but gives you wisdom. So quite frankly, if you're having a difficult time, if you're having problems, if you're down, feel upset, don't come here. Go to the beach, a part where there's not many people. Go up north, down south, a quiet place. Go to a nice lake, by yourself, not with people. Going with people is the problem. Talk all the time. Go by yourself. See if you can have silence therapy. Got any problems? If you are in research and development and you need to find a new way to solve this problem, for goodness sake, don't think about it. Do not look at more books. Do not listen to more conferences. Go out by yourself somewhere. Just be still. Stop thinking about it. And answers come up. Amazing. The innovation from silence is immense. And I finish off going over time. It was Brian Josephson, won a Nobel Prize in Physics for understanding the essential thing which supercomputers now rely upon. Similar thing to a transistor, but working at close to absolute zero temperatures. Innovative, incredibly remunerative supercomputers. And he got a Nobel Prize as well in physics. He discovered that, not through thinking about it, through meditating. So if you could meditate some more, who knows, the next Nobel Prize in physics can come from a Buddhist who lives in Western Australia. Who knows? But certainly I know that's where any wisdom I get comes from. Don't read that many books. Don't read too many articles. Don't go on the YouTube to get research before I give a talk. It all comes from silence. If you think I'm wise, don't believe what I say. You get silent too. And you develop your own wisdom. Your own freedom. Your own truth. And your own happiness and health. Thank you for listening. Sadhu! 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 Okay, I innovated that, three sadhus. The only monk in the world who does that. The only one crazy enough to do it. So we got some questions from overseas. It's all streamed live to many, many people. Two questions. First of all, from France, which is nice. Related to wisdom born from silence and beautiful chantings, is it wholesome to keep singing in a choir with guys I love when music becomes no more a necessity since I meditate? The answer is just be silent, feel it in your heart. Don't think about it, and certainly don't ask a monk or an expert. That's the trouble. People come and ask me. I'm supposed to be expert. Ajahn Pao, should I marry this girl? Should I change my job? Should I have the operation? What should I do? My job, again, is to keep you silent so you can find out for yourself. Is it wholesome to keep singing in the choir with guys I love? If you love those guys, of course go singing in the choir. Becomes no more a necessity since I meditate. Yeah, you meditate, but you must have enough time to sort of sing in the choir as well. If you love that and you find lots of joy, go for it. And you're French. French, you really admire them because they know how to be happy. At least they did in the old days. They did some amazing things. Their food. You guys invented the croissant, and I will always respect you for that. Bad for my health, but who cares? I'm going to die anyway. Might as well die with a smile on my face and a big belly. So yeah, please go for it. And if it's guys you love, if you don't have love and happiness in your life, look, if you just meditate, I've seen this before, this is especially in France, some monks I've known just meditate. You admire them just how much they meditate, but there's no oomph, there's no juice in their meditation. They get stuck. And that juice is, I often say, I call it service. Kindness, love, giving some good karma. You've got to balance it. If you give too much, you just get worn out. If you meditate too much, you get dry. So do things you love as well, and do the meditation, balance it from France, and then you have a wonderful time, and you have great meditation too. And from Sri Lanka, when meditating, you said to do something to relax the body. What do you actually mean by doing something to relax the body? Ah, from Sri Lanka, how is your body now? Is it tense or is it relaxed? So first of all, you've got to know what relaxation is and what tension is. And amazing, so many people don't know what that is. No wonder they get sick. Sometimes you get so used to having a tight, tense body, you don't know what relaxation is. I've come across people like that. May you have seen people like that. People who just do not know what it is to relax. So when they have a holiday, such as New Year's, instead of relaxing, they go and watch the fireworks. Bang! Bang! That's not relaxing. They go to a party, loud music, dancing up around. This is your holiday time. Relax, for goodness sake. But people don't know how to relax. That's a problem. So here, from Sri Lanka, you are feeling your body, and you're getting to know, is it relaxed? Is it tense? Mindfulness, when it focuses on the right area, you feel it. This is relaxed. And this is tense. You get to know what those words mean. They're not just words. They're pointing to something. Words are signposts. Relax. What does that mean? Follow the signposts and you'll be mindful of it. Once you get to where it's pointed to, you can feel relaxed or tense. It doesn't take that long. It's a simple thing to learn. You learn just, if I get worried and anxious, my body tenses up. If I just relax, let go, I'm loose. Many people just get afraid and tense with public speaking. If I ever see any of that coming, I'll just relax. I'm going to enjoy myself. Then you get loose, and I can feel my body loose. It's not tensing up, even when I give a talk. If you have to go to the doctor, you can actually relax. And so, you know, you go to the dentist over there, relax. You're not tensing up. He's my dentist in the room over there, Jake. He does many, many things. You know, once, he really blew it, because one of my teeth, I think it was cracked or something, had to remove it. And he kept it in his surgery as a relic, a possible relic. And he could have made a fortune from that if I get famous, especially after I die. And unfortunately, he moved surgeries, he moved the office, and he lost it. A big mistake, Mr. Dentist. We could have auctioned that and paid off everything for the nuns' monastery. Never mind. So now he wants another tooth. These are all healthy. You can't have them. I'm going to be very careful. I'm going to count my teeth next time I come to the dentist and make sure they're all there when I leave. Only joking. But yeah, so you learn how to relax the body. It's one of those other skills. Once you're mindful of the body, you soon find out how to relax it. And the nice thing about this is that the thing which you actually learn how to do, that is what letting go is. Because the reason I've been doing this the last year is that I've been teaching meditation for such a long time, and some people keep asking me, Ajahn Brahm, I know I have to let go, but how do you do it? What is letting go? I say, well, just let go, but that doesn't help. And, you know, get the old, you're holding a cup, put it down, that's letting go. It still doesn't help because they're seeing me do it. You've got to do it, and you've got to feel it. Not as a thought, but as something which is an experience. And that's why the simplest act of letting go, which you can feel the result straight away, is relaxing your body. You know, sometimes that people come up, you know, this was in the interviews I was doing in the recent retreat, and you can see them, you know, they're sitting up straight, tight, and they said, let go. They can't do it. So they said, lean back, drop your shoulders, just stretch out your feet. You're starting to let go. How does that feel? So trying to get people to feel what letting go is. And once you do that with your body, you let go, you get instant gratification. Relaxation is delightful. Tension is pain. You're learning. Now, simple things, but you're learning by doing it yourself, seeing it yourself, and then you learn what letting go is. And once you do that on your body, and you feel it's relaxing, letting go. It's exactly the same what you do in your mind. So what do people do when they've got a problem in the mind? Get rid of it. What do? You've got a pain in the body. Get rid of it. It makes it worse. Be kind to it. Oh, knee. You've been sitting like this for such a long time. You're okay. I still love you. I'm going to move you soon. It actually makes it feel better. It was aching a minute ago, but now it feels much better. You're letting it go, being kind. Now you know how to relax your body. And you do the same with your mind. Stupid mind. I made plenty of mistakes, said the wrong things so many times. I speak so much that it's actually quite amazing I don't get more emails complaining. But you relax. When you relax, you know how to let go. And even your emotional world gets very free and relaxed and healthy, like your body. Your past, your bad memories, terrible things may have happened to you in 2015. Things, oh, why did that happen? I wish it didn't happen. Do not try to get rid of it. That makes it worse. Instead, you let it be. Soften it, just like your body. You relax it. And just like the aches and pains, they disappear. So all the stupid things I did, the pain of the past, the things which I wish I'd never had done, all the fears of the future, everything like that, vanishes when you know how to let go. Now you've done that, you don't need to have a teacher anymore. You take that and that leads all the way to enlightenment. But you're doing it yourself, starting on the body, learning from the body, and transferring that skill to your mind and almost anything else. That's what I mean. That's why I do that exercise. To teach so you know how to meditate. And it's not the case. People think, I can't meditate. I'm hopeless. I'm too restless. I can't stop thinking. Never say that. It's not yet. You get the right skills. It's such an easy thing to do. And what a wonderful skill that is. Of all the skills to learn in life, learning how to be peaceful. Isn't that really worth? It's not just weight in gold. It's worth a fortune. And you learn that here for free. And you can teach it to your friends. Once you've learned it yourself. So, any questions from the audience here? Well, there is. Okay. Yes. John? Can you get a microphone to him? Oh, over here, John. Oh, you got a microphone? You got one? Go on. Wow.
Okay. Arjun, could you tell us a bit about this branch at Hong Kong, in Hong Kong?
My branch at Hong Kong is called BIF, a good Buddhist name, BIF. Bodhinyana International Foundation. That's what it's called. Bodhinyana is the brand. Now, one of the organizations in Singapore is called Bodhinyana Singapore. Bodhinyana International Foundation in Hong Kong. And what is it called? Bodhinyana Monastery down in Perth. See, this is how McDonald's started. Who knows where this might go. Anyway, in Singapore, just a group of disciples. Let's say the first ones came from Singapore, and they wanted to have talks in English in Buddhism which made sense. In other words, instead of going to a Buddhist talk and just listening to what you can read in a book, instead of having the theory, they just wanted to have. So that's when I started going over there. Ajahn Brahmani goes over there. Other monks will be going over there. I think Hasapanya goes over there because she can speak in Cantonese. And it's really powerful. Many people come, going to universities, and also to, where else it was? Universities, and even to Cathay Pacific, the airline. Go there every year, and the HR manager there, the human resources manager, the last time I went there, he said, what you said last year is now in my courses. I teach people throughout whole of Cathay Pacific, all the pilots, flight attendants, people to work on the ground. And if you want to know what he was teaching, the simple thing, the Emperor's Three Questions. That's in the first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. If you don't know it, you can find it on the internet so easy. The Emperor's Three Questions. He was so impressed by that simple story. Most important time now. Most important person is the one right in front of you. You, madam, you're the most important person in the world to me right now. You are, because you're right in front of me. Now someone else is. But that's how to relate to somebody. Don't get rid of them. Give them respect. They're important. And the most important thing to do is to be kind. No, it's actually to care. It was to care. Careful, caring. So simple that the whole of Buddhism can be put into that. Not Buddhism, the whole of spirituality. The whole of the essence of the HR, human resources, method in Cathay Pacific. Simple teaching. And so that's why, you know, that people in Hong Kong are really into this. Straight, simple Buddhism, explained not in theory, but in practice. Taking these great teachings and just mixing them up, presenting them in a way which even, he's a Christian, I think, I'm not sure, a Westerner, English guy, and he said, wow, this is good stuff. I can use this, you know, in my corporation, in the whole airline, to make it more competitive. And it's working. So that's actually what we do over there. Okay, it's past 9 o'clock. I had a late night tonight. I'm not going to have another late night tonight. So that's enough. So now, any more wisdom you want, be still. Find it out for yourself. Okay, I'm going to bow 3 times to the Buddha now. So don't go yet. We'll do the bowing first of all, and then you can all go.